Well, friends, seeking the light of God's Spirit on His own Word, we turn again to that chapter we read, the 23rd chapter of Luke's Gospel, and we'll read just now at verse 20. Luke 23, reading just now at verse 20. Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spake again to them. But they cried, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" They cried, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Well, this is a very solemn chapter. And there's a danger, and it's a danger I always feel very conscious of myself, that we become so used to its details that we can read the chapter and we know what's coming, we know what the next verse, the next section is going to say. We become so used to it that we stop thinking about it, and it stops affecting us as we read it. But the truth is, surely, that it should affect us every time we read it. It should make us pause, and more than pause, every time that we read it, because it is so solemn, so serious, so wonderful, and so astonishing, all at the same time. And in the chapter, of course, the storm which had been gathering around the Lord, gradually, day by day, is beginning to reach its final crisis. The betrayal by Judas is now past. He has now been arrested and was being taken to Herod, and then Pilate, and then from there to the place of crucifixion. Now, apart from his spiritual sufferings, which are of course the most important of them all, there was even physically a tremendous amount of suffering and pain on the part of the Lord here. Who can imagine what it meant to be taken by the whole multitude in verse 1 and led to Pilate, to finding yourself alone, without friend, without voice to defend you? The whole multitude arose and led him to Pilate. The sheer intimidation, the sheer force of hostility that is there is quite astonishing. And then to be the focus of such hostile attention, to be taken before Herod. He had nothing more to say to Herod. The day of talking with Herod was done. And then taken back again to Pilate. You remember how it's put in Psalm 22. Bulls many compass me. Strong bulls of Bashan me surround. Now, we passed some cattle and some bulls today. And some of them look very intimidating. To be surrounded by them, that must be an awful experience, even at the ordinary human level. And the bulls of Bashan apparently were noted for their ferocity and for their size and for their sheer power to intimidate. And he is surrounded by them. And then the image changes, of course, doesn't it, in the psalm, and it's the dogs, not friendly dogs, but the snarling, unclean city dogs snapping and snarling and showing their teeth. And in the midst of it all, the Son of Man. There had never been a moment like it in all of history. He had come to his own, and now, finally and fully and publicly, his own are not receiving him. And then there's this other man, Pilate, caught up so unhappily, so unwillingly in all of these events. He tries to put it as far away from himself as possible. He hears that he is a Galilean, so he will make it Herod's problem, but back comes the crowd. Time after time, he tries to secure his release. Verse 20, he speaks to them again. And then in verse 22, we have the reference to the third time. But all Pilate's efforts are doomed to failure. And eventually he himself begins to realize that there is no way out of this situation. He speaks to them, but back comes the cry, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And I want to focus with you just for a little on these words, and I want us to ask whose voices we hear here as they call for his crucifixion. And first of all, and most obviously, and most literally, it's the voice of the crowd. And they cry as one, and it's the language that's used here, it's of a yelling and a chanting. It was ominous, it was horrible, over and over, as they were whipped by the authorities, as the agitation and the excitement rose. Pilate is going to ask us, "You will say, crucify him." And the message spreads through the crowd. And out comes the governor. "What will I do with him? Crucify him. Crucify him. Crucify him." A baying mob. Isn't it interesting that they were unanimous? They couldn't achieve unanimity on anything else, this crowd. They disagreed on everything else. You have the Pharisees with their insistence on orthodoxy and keeping every single rule, and here they are, breaking them all. And alongside them, the Sadducees, the theological liberals of their day, and they are agreeing together, united in opposition to Christ. The Jewish race, the Roman authorities, they hated each other. You have the Jewish grouping. You have Herod, who was of course of a mixed grouping. And you have Pilate. They don't get on. But they come together, united as one, the whole world, as it were, rejecting Christ. Jew and Gentile speaking with one shameful, terrible voice. "Crucify him. Away with him. We will not have him. Remove him." It's the voice of the people. But even as they chant this, they know, and Pilate knew it, that there was an innocence to to the prisoner. They have already given testimony to that. We have it there in verse 22. I find no cause of death in him. And how fitting, friend, that in the midst of this clamour, in the midst of this accusation and condemnation, there is preserved for us in the Word a testimony to his innocence. How fitting that he would be found as a lamb without spot, without blemish. How fitting that at the very heart of this narrative, we would have yet one more testimony to his purity, to his cleanliness. Even as his enemies became his judges, they could find no fault in him. And Christian friend, you should give thanks today that your Savior, even as he stood condemned before a baying mob, had his innocence asserted and reasserted in that very arena. That he is the perfect man, the perfect one, the one who has clean hands and a pure heart, the one who had not lifted up his hands nor sworn deceitfully, the one in whom neither Jew nor Gentile nor the very court of heaven itself could find fault. And because of that, child of God, is it not the case that it can be said of you, clothed in his righteousness here today, that heaven finds no fault in you? Crucify him. They're rejecting him. But when you reject something, you also choose something else, don't you? And who are they choosing? What are they choosing? Children, you remember who they chose instead of Christ. They choose this other man, Barabbas. Pilate, in the midst of his confusion and fear, we believe, hits on a way out. There was the tradition, the release of the prisoner. I will chastise him and let him go. This is his way out of the dilemma. But Pilate is going to discover there is no way out. There is no easy exit from this. And they choose Barabbas. Just two comments about that before I move on. First of all, they chose something dangerous. How typical of Adam's race. Isn't that what they had been doing since sin first came in? They had chosen the danger. They had chosen what would prove ruinous. They chose what was dangerous. It's in verse 19. For sedition and for murder, this man had been cast into prison. This man was a danger to them. This man needed to be kept under lock and key. He was a danger to their families. He was a danger to their very society. And so is sin, friends. And yet, Adam's race, they choose sin, they choose what is dangerous before what is safe. They choose what is ill before what is good. But not only do they choose what is dangerous, but they choose what was foolish. What a foolish choice. They reject the healer, the teacher, the Savior, the Word who was with God and who was God. He is pushed to one side, and in his place the murderer. Oh, sin is foolish. Sin is madness. It's likely that if this man Barabbas were spared, he would go on to do worse. encouraged by release, encouraged by the support of the people. Perhaps some of them would come to regret his release. Perhaps a day would come when they would say, oh, that that man was still under lock and key. Indeed, that he had bore the penalty due to his sin. And that's the way sin is. If it's encouraged, it always does more damage. If we choose sin instead of Christ, it's a foolish choice. And it's a dangerous, deadly choice. And it will always cause us to regret it. Well, the people, they call with one voice. What a testimony to his humility. He comes so low. So low that he's considered lower than the criminal. And he consents to that. That verse in Philippians is just coming to my mind. He made himself of no reputation. So he thought it not robbery to be equal with God. No reputation. Whose voices do we hear here? We hear the voices of the crowd. But I think there's another voice behind the crowd. And it's the voice of darkness and the voice of the enemy. The voice of the dragon, the voice of Satan, the voice of hell itself. All their hatred came from him. Had Satan not tried to destroy him? Had he not tried it in Bethlehem? Had he not tried it, probably in the storm on the Sea of Galilee? Who knows? But here it is again. This same opposition. That this voice would be silenced. That this work would be taken and destroyed and broken, lest it go any further. And the forces of darkness, they gather. Now is your hour and the power of darkness. And they watch, manipulating the situation, manipulating the people. This is the battle. The hour at long last has arrived. The showdown that was inevitable from the moment that sin entered into these angels, that showdown was inevitable, and now it has come. The moment when they will meet. And when resolution and victory one way or another will be achieved. But maybe you're thinking, friend, well, doesn't Satan try to turn him away from the cross? You remember, through Peter, for instance, and on other occasions. Yes, he does, but we've got to remember that Satan is not all-knowing, and there was always the hope that he would fail. That somewhere in this process, he would stumble and fall. That somewhere through this grueling, arduous task, as he carried his church, as he carried his people, that he would stumble and that they and he would fall. That like the first Adam, he would come short. That like the first Adam, he would not be sufficient for the task. And that somehow, the darker power would have victory. But of course, in this, as in everything else, Satan is going to be defeated because the Lord is going to use that hostility. He is going to use these very voices stirring up hatred for his own ends and for his own good. Because we have behind it, as Peter captures it so beautifully in Acts 2, the determinate counsel and the foreknowledge of God. Oh, he overpowers and he destroys the first Adam. He robs him. He breaks him. But now comes this great champion to the field, the second Adam, the last Adam. And they will meet. And one must triumph. I think it's Chrysimus Evans, the Welsh preacher of long ago, who has a sermon which I remember reading on the forces gathered around the cross. And he speaks of the forces of darkness gathered there, watching and waiting to see what the result will be. And then he moves on later on and he has this phrase or something like it: seeing defeat, they slink away in all the agony of disappointment. They will slink away in all the agony of disappointment, forever defeated. Yes, we have the voices of the crowd united for this brief moment and yet confessing his innocence. We have the voice behind it of the forces of darkness. But you know, mysteriously, there's another voice. And it is the voice of heaven. And you say, surely not. Well, yes, it is so. Because divine justice too is calling for this crucifixion. My Father, he said, could send a legion of angels. My release could be done in a moment. I could be transported away from this awful scene of terror and destruction. But already in the garden, this whole issue of the cup, and the cup of wrath, and the cup of damnation, which he is going to drain to its dregs, already that issue has been dealt with. Not that it was ever, of course, in question. And the court of heaven, and the fair voice of divine justice calls also for this crucifixion. It must go ahead. And neither Pilate nor anyone else can derail it. If his people are to be saved, our Passover lamb must be sacrificed. The great burnt offering must be laid upon the altar and consumed. His soul must be made an offering for sin, and so the curse falls upon him. And divine justice can be satisfied with nothing less. He dies the death of a criminal, because in the sight of heaven he had become a criminal. He dies the death of the criminal for the criminals. He dies the death of the outcast for the outcasts. I think it's Professor Finlayson who, again in one of his sermons, and you'll know the passage probably yourselves, but he speaks of the three crosses. And in the center, the greatest, the most guilty of them all on the center cross, bearing this people's sins. The greatest of thieves, the greatest of liars, because of this burden that had become his, as he has made sin for them. Judged as the guilty one. So we have the voice of the crowd, insistent and horrible. We have the voice of darkness. We have the voice of the court of heaven. But there's one last voice. And it's his own. It's his own, friends. He has set his face like a flint. He would not be turned from it. He comes out to meet his captors in the garden. Peter, put away your sword. Whom seek ye? We seek Jesus of Nazareth. If you seek me, he said, let these go their way. I am he. And he comes bound. Bound by covenant obligation. What he had undertaken to do for his people. Having loved his own, he would love them to the end. Bound by covenant obligation, bound by obedience to his Father, for this is the Father's will. Not my will, but thine be done. Bound by love to his church, bound by love to divine justice. Pilate didn't know what way it would go. The crowd didn't know what way it could go. But there was one man there who knew exactly how it would go. He knew Psalm 22. And he knew that it was himself and his own experience. He knew that it would have to be that like water he would be poured out and his bones would go out of joint. He knew it all. And he is consenting and active in it all. Crucify him. Crucify him. I will scourge him and let him go, says Pilate. Surely that's enough. He'll be humiliated. He'll return to Galilee, a broken, chastened man, and he will never venture again to Jerusalem. But scourging is not enough for Jesus. And scourging is not enough for divine justice either. What is the wages of sin? Is it scourging? Is that what it says? The soul that sinneth shall be scourged. Is that what it says? No. The soul that sinneth shall die. And shall die with curse written over it. The sacrifices of the Old Testament weren't scourged. Blood was required. And blood would have to be shed. The substitute must die. Pilate offers a substitute, of course. But he could not be substituted. He was the substitute. And there is no substitute for the substitute. There can be none. And he said to them the third time, why? Oh, Pilate, you don't even begin to understand why. The why is hidden from you. Three times Peter denied him. but he repented. Three times Pilate justified him, and yet he condemned him. What a graphic picture of the world and the church in that snapshot. This is how it must be. Suffer it so now, he says. And so he goes. The condemned man. To meet his condemnation. And the cross will be raised up in the appointed place. And a supernatural darkness will fall. And judgment will be given. And the penalty will be paid. And then at last we hear it. Do you hear it? It is finished. It is done. No more is required. And the prisoners can be set free. And the guilty can be justified. And the outcasts can be brought in. And a new song can be sung. To him who loved us. And who gave himself for his people. And so it has to be. Crucify him. Crucify him.